Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea. Meghna Chakrabarty and Anthony Brooks are both out today.
Okay, so what we're doing is looking at how certain types of cognitive skills relate to taste perception.
That is David DeSteno, associate professor of psychology at Northeastern University, and he is lying.
What we're going to do is we've got a bunch of tasks here. The first thing I'm going to ask you guys to fill out is something about your taste preferences, because that can affect things, tastes that you like, tastes that you don't like. We've got cognitive measures here, things that are like mental rotation, things that people love to do.
The experiment he's conducting here actually has nothing to do with cognition, taste, or perception. It has everything to do with the two volunteers, Caitlin and Jack, who DeSteno has put to work filling out questionnaires and taking tests, all of which are meaningless, by the way.
According to legend, what is the only thing that can kill a werewolf?
Silver bullet.
I'm glad you know that one.
Oh, I know my werewolf literature, I guess.
Complete the puzzle below by filling in the blanks with the missing letters using the hint.
What are they doing?
Right now they're working on a task that's presented to them as measuring their general knowledge. Really what it's meant to do is just give them fun questions, trivia questions to work on together. It's all about just building a little bit of a rapport and pleasant working relationship.
Clean sweep. So what might a clean sweep refer to?
Where did you get these tests from that are utterly meaningless?
Sitting around the lab for a long time generating trivia questions.
What is the largest known carnivorous dinosaur?
It's Gigantosaurus.
All right, let's go with it.
When I was five, I was big on dinosaurs.
Yeah.
This process isn't about measuring knowledge of any kind. It's actually about measuring jealousy. DeSteno directs the Social Emotions Lab at Northeastern, where he's run this experiment dozens of times. And we've asked him to come and do it again in our office kitchen, on which we can eavesdrop from the radio studio down the hall.
What does it mean for a word to be a palindrome? I know that one.
Mm-hmm. What we're trying to look at is how relationships start and jealousy unfolds. And one of the things that our lab is known for is studying it in real time. You know, you can't really study jealousy by asking people, would you be jealous? Most people would say no, whether they're lying to you to protect their self-esteem or whether they really believe they wouldn't. But when push comes to shove, the things we'll feel sometimes surprise us. And here's a way that we can study it, by forming a relationship, a very budding one, and watching it unfold.
You should probably just pick one.
Yeah, just go with that.
Is the italicized statement true or false? The area of a triangle is equal to...
I actually lied a little bit before, too, because Jack and Caitlin are not both volunteers. Caitlin is, and she thinks Jack is, but Jack is what researchers call a confederate, acting on DeSteno's instructions.
What Jack's trying to do is to show that he really enjoys working with Caitlin.
As they work together, Jack leans in, he smiles, makes a lot of eye contact. Did I mention he's disgustingly handsome and that's why we picked him for this job?
So we should just go with
true. Yeah, we should go with true.
What comes next is going to be the interesting part. What happens when Jack has a choice of who he wants to work with, and how will that affect her? That's where we can see, does jealousy happen in real time, and what does it lead people to do?
How about you?
Professor DeSteno walks into the room with Jessica, ostensibly another volunteer who's arrived late, but she's actually a Confederate, like Jack, and not so bad-looking herself.
Great. I'm sorry.
So are we all three of us working together now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
What are we doing?
We're trying to figure these out.
It's like trivia questions, basically.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what an Eames original is?
So now what Jessica is doing is starting to direct most of her attention toward Jack. And Jack will beginning to give more of his attention toward Jessica than toward Caitlin, who he had been working with. What we expect to happen is that Caitlin's going to notice that this attention isn't equal, and the fun she was having in working with Jack and his attention toward her is going to be shifting, which is going to be interpreted at some level, even subconsciously, as a threat, as, maybe he values this person more than me, and why is that?
Right? I mean, yeah. Let's say that.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
handsome Jack starts to lean in toward Jessica, making eye contact with her, making her feel special. Caitlin, who, remember, is the only one here who actually thinks this is a test about cognition and taste perception or whatever, Caitlin soldiers on, working with this new three-person team. And here is where the experiment gets really cruel. Professor DeStano goes back in.
Okay, guys, how far did you get?
Almost done, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got to time it, so let's stop on there. Now, what we're going to do is the mental rotation stuff. So you got to do this together or alone. So somebody's going to have to work on their own. So I don't want to bias it. You guys can figure out what you want to do.
I worked with you. I guess worked with you this time.
Sure. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now what happened is Jack had to choose who he wanted to work with, and Jack chose to work with Jessica, and I moved them down to the other end of the table where they're going to carry on and continue working a bit while Caitlin is now stuck on her own.
So we should all get started?
How did they look when Jack chose Jessica over Caitlin?
There looked a little surprise in her face.
I feel so bad about this.
Here's always the trade-off we have. To be able to really study human behavior, you have to be able to put people in situations. And so this is going to be a little uncomfortable, but it's nothing that wouldn't really happen.
Poor Caitlin sits in silence, flipping through her test packet. At the other side of the room, Jack and Jessica carry on, making eyes. And here's where the experiment moves from the cruel phase to the downright sadistic phase.
Now I'm going to go in and have them start doing the taste perception task. And that's where the opportunity to exact a little revenge can come up.
All right, guys, now we're going to do the taste perception stuff. I'm going to bring you all to separate rooms because we don't want any distractions. So
DeStano takes the Confederates, Jack and Jessica, out of the room. Caitlin, our jilted guinea pig, is left in the room with DeStano's research assistant, Paul.
Okay, so we're going to do the next part of the taste perception task.
Okay.
So
right now, Paul is giving Caitlin instructions for preparing what's presented as a taste perception test. And inside the box are three different substances, one sweet, which is chocolate syrup, one fruity, which is a cherry fruit drink, and one spicy, which is a bottle of evil-looking hot sauce. And what we say to them is we don't want to bias people's taste perceptions, and so we're having each subject prepare taste samples for the others.
Experimenters, we don't want to influence these results or anything, so we're going to let our participants put together taste samples for each other.
Sure.
So you're going to put one.
And Caitlin, who's our subject here, has been randomly assigned to prepare the spicy samples. And so she has two plastic cups in front of her, and she also has the taste preference questions, which indicate that both Jack and Jessica really do not like spicy foods. And what we're going to see is how much she puts in there, as Paul's going to tell her everything she puts in those little sample cups, which are kind of like little salad dressing cups you see at salad bars, will be placed in its entirety in their mouth. She knows they don't like it. The bottle is labeled as extremely hot. And so it's a commonly used way to assess people's aggressive intent. The more you put in there, the more is going in their mouth, the more is going to hurt.
So what do people usually do when you do this in your lab?
When we've done this in our lab, it was amazing. And so what people normally do is they will put in, you know, 7 or 8 more grams of this hot sauce. So picture a little plastic cup. Normally they know it's really hot. And so we have conditions where there isn't any jealousy occurring. So where we'll end it, but where in this case Jack wouldn't have gone off to work with Jessica. And people put in very little bits because they know it's a noxious substance. They know he doesn't like it.
So that's the control group.
The control group. Just enough because they know they have to put something in for the sample. In the conditions where he left to go work with the other person, in this case, when Jack left to go work with Jessica, the real subject, who is Caitlin in this case in our lab, tends to really load the cup up. And how much they load it corresponds pretty much to basically how much jealousy they report. Which is a pretty interesting index, because most people, if I said to you, would you be jealous of someone that you've worked with for 5 minutes, enough to punish them? They'd say, no way. But here you see it unfold in real time.
So how much hot sauce did Caitlin punish Jack with?
I put in the smallest amount that I could possibly put in while still allowing them to have a taste of it, because I assume that it was required that they are able to taste it. So I think I put in like 2 shakes or something like that.
It's a very, very noble showing. So it turns out Caitlin is a graduate student in clinical psychology, of all things, and she kind of saw right through us.
I wasn't on to you until I saw that I was assigned to administer Tabasco sauce to 2 people who apparently hate spicy foods. And then I thought, I don't know, there's something a little fishy about this, that both people hate spicy foods.
Well, whatever. Science is all about the aggregate results, right? Not the individual. And what David DeStano's research shows us is that more often than not, people will load up that cup with hot sauce. So, David, what does this experiment tell you about jealousy?
What it tells us is that the capacity for jealousy, the capacity to kind of seek revenge and punish people for kind of transgressing against us, is just an inherent part of being human. You know, in our culture, jealousy's got this real negative stigmatization. And the question is, if it's so bad, why does the brain have it, right? The brain doesn't have evil mechanisms, evolution shaped that it should serve a purpose. And the reason we have it is because it's designed to protect relationships and to punish people for breaking them. And here, you know, it's just a mild case in our research, but what this paradigm shows is that even after knowing someone for 10 minutes, when their attention goes towards someone else and that budding relationship is threatened, we're going to have that pang of jealousy, and most of us are going to respond in ways that biologically make sense, even though they're something we're not morally proud of.
How do you define jealousy?
Jealousy is a negative emotional experience that you have when your relationship is threatened. Now, we tend to use jealousy in our culture as, I'm jealous of your car, or I'm jealous of your job. That's really envy. It's a different thing. Jealousy is really about relationships, whether it's kids and a parent, whether it's workers and a boss, or whether it's romantic partners and a potential rival. What it is that negative blend of like anger and fear that we feel that motivates us to do something to protect our relationships. It usually works well when you start to get a sense that someone is showing interest in someone else, because it motivates you that, hey, if you value this person, you better do something about it.
We're speaking to David DeStano, director of the Social Emotions Lab at Northeastern University, and we're talking about the research he's done on jealousy. And just a warning, we're about to get into some territory that might not be appropriate for younger listeners. In this experiment that we just did, you know, the lab rat was a young woman in whom we were trying to, you know, elicit or at least isolate feelings of jealousy. Do you ever do this with the genders reversed?
We have done it with the genders reversed. And what you find is exactly the same pattern. So men are just as willing to feel jealousy, whether they want to admit it or not, and to seek vengeance by punishing the other person. The only difference is men on average just give a lot more hot sauce in general, but still, right? But still, when the person leaves to go work with another partner, they still ramp it up, you know, the same relative amount trying to punish that person.
Well, that surprises me, because when you talk about innate differences in the sexes, I generally feel like jealousy is one of these things where men and women react in different ways.
You would think that. And in fact, for a long time, there has been this view based on evolutionary theory that men and women are jealous of different things. So let me start by asking you a question, Adam. And you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but you can. Imagine the two following things. First, imagine your partner engaging passionately in different sexual positions with someone else.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, imagine your partner saying, I love you, and forming kind of a deep emotional bond to someone else. Which now they both bother you, but which of those two would make you feel more jealous?
Oh, man. My reptile brain is going for option A. Like, I mean, honestly, I got a bad feeling in my stomach when I envisioned my partner in various compromised positions. I'm going to go with option A.
Okay. I think you've actually hit it right on the head, although for lots of reasons I don't like the term reptile brain, but let's go with it. your gut was telling you option A, and then you had some ambivalence about it. Well, what you find if you ask men and women this question is a very reliable difference. Men, on average, are pretty evenly split. Slightly more often, they'll say, yeah, picturing, you know, my wife or girlfriend having sex with someone else is worse, kind of like you did. But they're torn. Women almost 80% of them will say flat out, I love you. That's the worst thing.
That's the
worst thing. And so for a long time, people said, well, of course, this is a sex difference, and that's tied to our genes. And the reason is that, you know, basically, biologically speaking, sperm is cheap. There's lots of it around, and you're always making more.
Right.
For women, they're born with a number of ova they're going to have, and it takes 9 months to gestate a baby, and there's lots of metabolic effort into it. And so you really want to be sure that the person who you're going to mate with is going to stay around and invest in the child. And so they're more worried about the long-term relationship part than the sex. At least that's the way the story goes. Well, we had a problem with this view for lots of reasons. And what we thought is, well, we think the reason women are saying the I love you bothers them more is because there's a different expectation of what it means. So let me ask you another question. If a man says I love you to a woman, how likely is it that there's going to be sex going on? Probably pretty likely. If I say to you, if a man has sex with a woman, how likely is it that there's going to be some long-term attachment? Right. And so really what happens is women hold the expectation that men can have sex without having a long-term attachment. But if they're going to have a long-term attachment, well, damn it, there's going to be sex as well. Whereas men don't hold that. They assume that if women are having a sexual attachment, there's going to be love. And if there's love, there's sexual attachment. And so really what happens is when women think about this question, they have that same innate response that we all did, that men do, which is, ugh, picturing my partner having sex with someone else. But what makes them choose the fact that the I love you bothers them more is because it's like a double shot. It's two for one. If you're forcing me to choose between these two things, well, if I say sex, that's bad. But if I say I love you,
it's
love and sex, and so that's worse.
Right.
Whereas men don't have the same view of what it means for a woman. And so that's why women choose it, because it's this rational, thought-out, if-then, what does this mean? So to prove this, right, what we simply did was we would have people make decisions under something called cognitive load, which is basically a way to prevent you from thinking about what does it mean? If there's sex, could there be, if there's love, is there going to be sex? And thinking about all the if-thens. What it does is basically just give the reptilian response, to use your terminology.
Can you put a cognitive load on me right
sure,
now?
Sure, yeah, sure. Okay. So I'm going to give you seven numbers, and I want you to basically remember those seven numbers while I ask you a question, and then answer the question, and then spit the seven numbers back to me.
Okay.
Okay, Adam, here are the numbers. 432-6175. What bothers you more, imagining your partner having sex with someone or imagining your partner saying I love you to someone?
Having sex with someone.
Numbers.
432-6175.
Great. There you go. And what that does is it prevents you, or women in this case, from saying, which bothers me more? Well, sex really bothers me. But you know what? Oh, he could probably have a one-night stand. But if he says, I love you, oh, there's going to be even more sex. And so it prevents that kind of if-then trading in the mind, rationalizing. It gives you the gut response. We do this all the time with lots of questions when we want the kind of gut response to things. And if you make people answer this question under a cognitive load, what you find is that the sex difference goes away. Women, just as much as men, say, sex is what really bothers me the most. You know, there's lots of theories about what underlies jealousy, and there are biological theories about sex difference, et cetera. There are cultural differences. It's all a cultural construct. What we argue is what it really is about is self-esteem. Why? Because what self-esteem, and Mark Leary at Duke has a great theory on this, what self-esteem does is it functions as kind of what he calls a sociometer. That is, it tells you where you stand vis-a-vis people you care about. If they're showing you attention, it means they like you. If they withdraw it, your self-esteem goes down. It means your position with them is really threatened. And so what we wanted to show is that's what really drives jealousy. How do we do that? We ask people, what's really important to you? So I might say to you, Adam, Is it more important to you that your intelligence, your popularity, your athleticism? We found out what was important to people in terms of defining themselves.
Okay, so say I say athleticism is the most important
Great.
Thing to me.
So then what we would do is we would say, so imagine you're at a party, and imagine your partner is now talking with someone, and that person's flirting with them. How much would it bother you if that person were, and then colon. And then following that colon were different types of people. Someone who was, you know, really intelligent and successful. Someone who was high in athleticism. Someone who was really popular. And what we found is that even though the exact nature of the flirting was the same, people would be much more jealous of the person who excelled on the domain that was important to them. So, Adam, you might be much more jealous of someone who is a really imposing athletic figure versus someone who has, you know, a high IQ. And the reason is because if the signal that your partner showing interest in someone else means that they have something up on you, if the thing they have up on you is the thing you care about, it's going to bother you
right.
a lot more.
It undermines what I value
it
about myself.
You a lot more. That's right. And that's what jealousy is. It's a signal. If your partner likes you, they probably value this too. And you know what? Maybe this person is more intelligent, more athletic, more popular, makes more money. Whatever that domain is that's important in your relationship, they've got more of it.
Okay. So let's say that I value intelligence mm-hmm. above all else. I value my mind. Mm-hmm. And I catch my partner cheating on me with a complete dolt. How is that? What's that going to do to me emotionally?
Well, you know, if you catch your partner cheating on you with anybody, you're going to be, you know, devastated and jealous. What we've shown, though, however, is the amount that it bothers you, the amount that it eats at you, is more if they excel in the domain that you care about. I think what you're going to have in the other way around the example that you said is this jealousy, but a kind of what are you thinking moment at the same time that you're feeling jealous.
Yeah, I think I feel like I would be disgusted more than jealous.
Yeah. Because in some sense, right, people feel disgusted when they feel a principle is being violated and you're like, are you the person that I thought you were? How could you do this? This makes no sense.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it could undermine my feeling of that, my feeling that I understand my partner.
Sure. Because your assumption is that if your partner likes you, they like you for the skills normally that you like in you. And, you know, there are lots of cultures where if a man finds that his wife was cheating with someone else, the way they repair it is the rival comes and pays him. Because the issue is not so much that, especially if there are multiple wives, that he's feeling so bad that one of them cheated, it's that he's lost honor. He's lost his status. Mm. And the way to repair that is for the person who she cheated with to come and make some type of payment or supplication to him to restore his honor. So in the cases where you have more than one wife, and you may not care so much about each person individually, it really is about honor. And there again, you can see that's what jealousy is all about.
David, has doing this research informed how you look at the relationships in your own life?
Yeah, I think so. I think it has, especially in terms of my kids. You know, I have young kids, and there's oftentimes, not so much now, but when they were younger, lots of issues about jealousy between them. And, you know, when we would show attention toward one, the other would get upset. And so we've learned to manage it by making it clear that what's going on is when we praise one of you, it's not that we devalue the other one any less. It's just that we're taking turns and showing appreciation. So in that sense, it has.
What about in your intimate relationships?
In my intimate relationships, sure. I think maybe it explains to me why certain times I may have twinges of jealousy. And then you're in this strange position of, you know, psychoanalyzing yourself in real time. And that's all I'm going to say on that one.
Well, Dr. David DeStenno, thank you so much for joining us and running that rat, that poor rat through the maze with us.
Yeah.
She was a very nice rat, though.
She was.
David DeStenno directs the Social Emotions Lab at Northeastern University. He's the co-author of the book Out of Character, Surprising Truths About the Liar, Cheat, Sinner, and Saint Lurking in All of Us. Still to come, an urbanist's love letter to that great big shoebox in the sky.
There are a few buildings from mid-century modernism that have entered the canon of distinguished architecture. The Prudential Center is not one of them.
But in the 1960s, it just may have saved downtown Boston. Stay with us. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.